Welcome to another episode of Conversations on Transformation, our series of interviews from the STEG Annual Conference 2024. My name is Tim Phillips and I'm at NYU Abu Dhabi to talk to the experts who understand the challenges and opportunities of structural transformation and economic growth. In Mexico, as in many developing and emerging economies, millions of people work in the informal economy. Governments want to formalize employment as part of the process of development, but how should they go about it? And how much would those employees value a formal job? Brenda Samaniego de la Parra of University of California, Santa Cruz, has been using data from Mexico to try to answer those tricky questions. I started our conversation by asking how big Mexico's informal sector is, which, as I quickly discovered, is a more complicated question than it seems.
All right. So I don't want to be a stickler for definitions and terminology, but I'm going to start by making a couple of distinctions here so that we're sure that we're all on the same page, because this is an important thing in the informality literature. So I want to distinguish between informal economy, informal sector, and informal employment.
Wow.
Yes, all of them are different, related. So informal employment is essentially all of the work that is hired off the books, that is unregistered, that doesn't have access to social security benefits, pensions, healthcare, and that's somehow not covered by a regulatory framework, things like minimum wages. Now, informal sector refers to the unit of production. So whether the firm itself is hiding from the government in some way. So the informal sector has informal employees, because if the firm itself is hiding from the government, then it doesn't have a tax ID, and hence it's unable to register a worker because there's no firm associated with that.
I would imagine the formal sector has informal employment, am I correct?
You might imagine it. And, you know, my job market paper is actually documenting the extent to which that exists in Mexico. So to answer your question about like how large is the informal economy, which would be the correct term, because informal economy encompasses both informal employment and the firms, so the informal sector. Informal employment in Mexico is about half of all employment. So 50% of workers in Mexico are either informally employed at a formal firm or they're working the informal sector in one capacity or other. They might be self-employed people who don't register their work with the government, or there might be informal firms altogether where every single worker is hired off the books. The firm doesn't report any information to the government, doesn't pay any taxes. So it encompasses all of this, and it's about 50%. So half of all employment in Mexico. And this number is very persistent. So crisis come, crisis go, pandemic comes, pandemic goes. And the number has been very resilient. So it's an important question. It is also not a Mexico-specific phenomenon. There's a lot of it across Latin America, across a lot of developing countries. And I would even argue that if we focus down to informal employment, so again, the type of jobs that are not protected by regulatory frameworks, even in developed countries, the rise of the gig economy makes it such that now the type of contracts that we think of as informal are actually now existing also in developed countries as well.
That is a huge number.
No. Across a lot of countries, it's huge. I would say that any person doing research in this set of countries, if you're ignoring the informal sector, you're leaving out half of the economy.
Yes. Does the government want to shrink this?
Yes, I would say they do, as evidenced by the fact that there's a lot of policies out there. The aim is to make it smaller. And there's a few reasons why, you know, policymakers and academics and the government in general is interested in making it smaller. The obvious one is that informality reduces state capacity via a reduction in tax revenue. And then beyond that, there's other arguments that the existence of an informal economy causes misallocation, right? There's like firms that are unfairly, let's call it, not paying taxes and competing with other firms that are following the rules and hence facing higher costs. So that reallocates resources towards like smaller, less productive firms, inhibits growth. So there's like an argument about structural transformation and growth that also motivates the government to shrink the informal economy. To counter that a little bit, there's like an open question about whether the optimal size of the informal sector is really zero. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not clear. And some people argue the government, to some extent at least, maybe turns a blind eye to the existence of informality, or at least some informality, because if it were to really crack down on all of the 50% mm-hmm. of employment yes. in the economy, you know, which country can sustain 50% unemployment rates? To answer your question, I think, yes, they're trying to shrink it. Whether they're trying to completely eliminate it, I guess, it's an open question, because while the optimal size of informality might not be zero, it's certainly not 50%.
Why do employers want informal employees?
Yeah. So if anything, to be honest, at some point when I started, you know, studying this, I felt like the right question to ask is, why do they want formal ones? Right? Like, the costs are really high.
Yeah.
Enforcement is low and it's hard to do. You know, there's tons of very small businesses that very easily hide. Once mm-hmm. you catch them, they shut their doors down and disappear the next day. So enforcement is low and it's limited. The costs are high. So then, you know, firms facing this trade-off between avoiding payroll taxes, minimum wage laws, termination costs, and facing the risk of getting caught, mm-hmm. they choose to have informal workers.
And for the employees, the workers, what do they want? Do they want to become formal then? You know, there's benefits for them. Are they happy to be informal? Do they want to be informal? What do they think?
So I think here the different types of informality. Informality is this very wide and broad, complex
yeah.
phenomenon, right? So there's some informal workers who are self-employed. Those workers, some more argue, they want to be informal. They don't want to pay taxes on revenue. They like the flexibility of being able to fire people and hire people whenever there's an economic shock. So for those, there's an argument that there's a benefit to being informal. For the type of workers that I focus on in a lot of my research, these are the workers that we were talking about that are employed by a formal firm.
Mm-hmm.
So for those workers, the hours are similar, the occupation is similar. So it's not that you're going to all of a sudden become more productive if you're formal, or that you're going to be working a more stable number of hours. So the benefits are not of that type. Mm-hmm. Instead, when a worker who is already in the formal sector, but they're informally employed,
yes.
when those workers get formalized, what changes is they get access to a wide range of social security benefits that are financed through payroll contributions.
I see.
For someone from a developed country like the US, the social security benefit is actually a lot narrower. In Mexico, it's very wide. So it includes things like free healthcare,
mm-hmm.
a pension fund, a subsidized mortgage loan, free daycare centers.
Wow.
For mothers, during the first 6 months of life, they get diapers, they get free formula. So it sounds
fantastic.
It's a lot. So they get all these benefits in paper. Which is an important distinction as well, of course,
mm-hmm.
because at the same time, in order to bridge the gap of this large segment of the population that is informally employed and hence doesn't have access to things like healthcare and maternity leave and whatnot, the government created a parallel system. Mm. And in so doing, of course, created terrible incentives. If you're low income and not formally employed, then you get access to similar government-provided benefits, but without having to make a contribution. So, you know, to the question of, like, do workers want to be formal? That's precisely one of the questions that I'm trying to answer in this
yes.
new paper that's called What is the Value of a Formal Job? How much is a formal job worth? It's an open question. I think it's crucial. I think policymakers assume that a formal job is a good one. Organizations like the ILO, the World Bank, they have this agenda of, like, let's create better jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And what they mean is let's create formal jobs. Do we want formal jobs? Like, do workers want formal jobs? Would they be willing to take a wage cut that is as large as what it costs a firm to formalize a worker?
But I have one more question before we get into what's
yes.
in the paper. And that is, if you are informal or formal, do you stay in those lanes? Is there an interchange between the two?
Yes. So that's also a great question and something that was hard to document precisely because of data, right? So you need to be able to observe people, the same person moving between formal and informal jobs, and administrative data is by definition missing. So one of the things that I do is I use data from household surveys that includes information about when the formality status of a worker. So I'm able to track workers through time and see whether they have access to these benefits, whether they're covered by regulatory protections or not. And I use that to classify them as informal or formal. So then I can observe the transitions across these employment types. And importantly, I can observe whether the transition happens within the same firm or across the same firm. So equipped with that data, what I do is I document the patterns of transitions. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I find is that, you know, a lot of people refer to informal workers. And I think that's, again, a misnomer. There's no such thing as a worker that
it's
is...
It's not an informal worker. There are informal jobs.
Oh, jobs, exactly. And there's a lot of transitions. So the most common way for you to get access to a formal job is by starting off as an informal job with a formal employer and then being formalized with that same employer. Uh-huh. So these transitions to formality occur within the same firm. It's also common that there's the opposite transition. You have a formal job and then you do some informal spell. Those transitions tend to occur when moving to a new job.
The research, it all hinges on these inspection visits to workplaces. So who's doing these inspections? How often do workplaces get inspected and what are they being inspected for?
Yes. So yeah, my work leverages a lot of these enforcement actions, inspection visits that the government in Mexico does. Part of that is because, you know, like most empirical research, studying the causes and the consequences of informality faces two very important challenges. So one of them we already talked about, which is data. The informal sector is not observed, so I have to jump through some hoops to be able to identify them credibly. And then the second challenge is exogeneity. People don't just randomly walk into a formal job or get offered a formal job. Instead, the probability that you have a formal job is related to who you are, what your productivity is, your gender, your location, etc. And all of those things determine some of the outcomes that we want to study. So what we want is like a helicopter drop of formal jobs across a random set of the population. And it turns out that the Mexican government does something that approximates that. They do random inspections. So they select establishments at random that they visit.
I wouldn't expect that. I would expect them to select establishments where they'd find something.
Yes. So not all of the enforcement is randomly selected. That's true. And the Ministry of Labor also has some inspections that are not random, that target certain locations. For example, during the pandemic or certain events that somehow raise the risk for a worker of being employed at a particular place, then that will make it more likely that the establishment gets inspected. Like during the pandemic, they visited establishments that maybe were at higher risk of violating health standards of social distancing. But this inspection that I focus on, randomly selected. So they do not depend on the establishment type, location, size, which is a crucial one. Usually they inspect. And I was speaking to some of the enforcers of these policies in Mexico. They told me, I like this site quite a bit. They said, we don't hunt in the jungle. We hunt in the zoo. Right? The animals are already locked in, like in cages. So we know where to find them. And that's an important component of the inspections. But the ones that I look at, randomly select.
So these workplaces have an inspection. The inspectors find informal employees. What's the sanction?
There are some important nuances to that question as well. So yeah. I think during the sample period that I focus on, the Ministry of Labor, to a large extent, play the role of what you might call the good cop. So what I mean by that is they show up and they are like nice to the establishment and they tell them like, listen, these are the rules. These are the labor regulations. This is why you want to abide by them. Make sure that you follow these rules. You're going to have happy workers, more productivity. So they spell out all of the potential benefits of following the rules. And in the particular case of informal employment, the institution that is actually in charge of fining and collecting the taxes and whatnot is the Social Security Administration. Uh-huh. So they're the bad cop.
Okay.
So one of the things that the Ministry of Labor does is if they show up and they find that you have informal workers, they tell you all these nice things and they say, but I have to tell the bad
cop. I have to tell the bad cop. And they're going to come and...
And they might come and if you still have these workers, they're not going to be happy. So the way that I interpret these random inspections that I use is that they actually increase the probability of a visit by the bad cop. Uh-huh. And they increase the probability that if they do impose a fine, they're going to choose the upper bound of that fine. And in so doing, they increase the expected cost of keeping an informal worker. So in that sense, these inspections are useful for identification purposes because it's not that they're mechanically raising formality all of a sudden. They're moving the bar of like the cost that the firm faces.
Right. So the firm can still make the decision.
Of course. Yes.
But to track this, you need the data. Mm-hmm. So do you have to then combine the data on the inspections in the workplaces with what you're getting from the household surveys, just so you preserve that knowledge about informality?
Exactly. Yes. And that was a big endeavor. It's complicated. Yes. Luckily, the Mexican government, through the Statistic Institute, to the Central Bank, to the Ministry of Labor, we have some amazing data. So they, you know, the household surveys, like I said, we're able to see workers, we're able to see their movements across different types of jobs across time. We're also able to see their households, a lot of socioeconomic characteristics, education. And then on top of that, they ask households for each member of the household, where is this person employed? What is the name of their employer? So using the name of the employer, I can then match the data to the government's inspection logs. Mm-hmm. So I can see for every firm that was eligible for an inspection, I can track the household members that are employed at that firm at different points in time.
Right. So how do the firms react when the cost of their informal employees, as we've discussed, rises?
Yes. In order to study that question, I actually leverage another type of data as well. So I also have access to administrative data.
Right.
That includes the universe of formal matches in the country. So there I can see for any given firm, what is the total size of its formal employment? So the composition of its workforce, its wage bill as well. And then I can see the source of the new hires. And what I mean by that is I can see whether a person that is suddenly formalized at a firm, whether they come from another formal firm, so if they were poached, mm-hmm. or if they come from outside of the formal sector. So with this administrative data, I cannot say whether that person was previously unemployed or just out of the labor force, or whether they were one of the informal workers that the firm had that they decide to formalize. But it's informative to see these different like origins of the workers. And what I find is interesting and initially for me, potentially a little bit counterintuitive. I found that total formal employment at a given firm that was inspected actually declines after an inspection. And the numbers are big. A year after the establishment's first inspection, total formal employment is 11% lower. So these are firms that look the same. They have similar industry, similar location, similar size before the inspection occurs. And then a year later, all of a sudden, they're 11% smaller in terms of their formal employment. Actually, the gap even increases with more time. Like it goes up to like 15% 18 months after the inspection. And this isn't driven by exit.
So just to clarify that, you have formal employees and informal employees at the same firm. Mm-hmm. The cost of the informal employees goes up. The quantity of the formal employees goes down.
Formal employment growth goes down. So it could be the case that, you know, the firms were going to be growing in size. Uh-huh. And it's just the case that the firms that were treated grow by less.
Brent, that makes no sense to me. Why does it happen?
We were also initially partially shocked by it.
You must have assumed initially that you just made a mistake.
I did. Yeah. I did. And we thought like, yes, there must be some coding error here. So we reviewed the code painstakingly for a while. And then once we were convinced that this wasn't driven by some error, then we thought, well, there's a lot of policies out there that have unintended consequences. So perhaps this is an example of that. So we started looking more into what was the driver of this drop. So one of the things that we do to look at that is we distinguish between hires and separations. So one of the reasons why a firm might grow at a slower rate than another one is because maybe they're hiring less or mm-hmm. because they're firing more. We find that drop in total formal employment is actually initially driven by both. So there's a decline informal job hiring and an increase in formal job separations. But as time passes, the negative gap in this formal employment growth is due to increasing differences in formal hires. So there's less and less formalization. So at that point, we were like, okay, well, now we know something about the labor flows, but it doesn't really explain why that would happen, right? We know that there's still a higher cost of informal employment. So why are there fewer formal hires? What we noticed now using the household survey is, like I was mentioning earlier, actually a lot of the inflows into formality come from informal jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent that these firms stop hiring and having informal workers, they're actually shutting down one of the main inflow mechanisms
yeah.
for their formal workforce. They have less informal workers, so they have less stock of workers to formalize.
Looking at that as a recruitment strategy, that would seem to be a very good one. You have someone who's working for you already, you know if they're good at their job before you want to formalize them, I guess. Now, we've looked at this from the point of view of the government, from the point of view of the employer. What does this mean from the point of view of the worker?
Yes. So in the quarter of inspection, and this is something more along the lines of what I would say you would expect, the probability of participating in a formal job increases in any capacity. And by that, I mean, maybe you all of a sudden start your own formal business. Maybe the firm that you're working on formalizes you. Maybe that you get a formal job at a different firm. That probability overall increases. This happens without a change in your net wage
mm-hmm.
or hours. So you're doing the same job, you're working the same number of hours, but now all of a sudden you have this access to a formal job. So again, it seems like almost like a helicopter drop
uh-huh.
of jobs that are formal. And this increase is driven by higher formalization rates within the same firm that you were employed at.
That's more what you would expect. Now, mm-hmm. you've also got new work at the moment, and you're looking at how much workers value a formal job. For that, you look at employment within the households. It's ingenious what you've done. So tell me, what happens in the households when one partner's workplace is inspected? That's what it turns on, isn't it?
It is. This work, by the way, is co-authored with Bhavya Sharma,
mm-hmm.
who's a fifth-year PhD student at the UC Santa Cruz program. She's going to be on the market next year, and she's fantastic. So I wanted to make sure that I highlight this, because a lot of the technical work, both a lot of the modeling and estimating in this work, got pushed forward thanks to Bhavya. Credit where credit is due. The idea there arose because of the fact that a lot of the benefits of formality actually accrue not just to the worker, but to their family members as well.
Mm.
So not just you get healthcare, but not just you. Your partner gets healthcare. Your kids also get healthcare. If you have a more stable job, then that will also affect the choices that your household makes. If formality has a positive benefit and we can think of it as an income shock,
mm-hmm.
then maybe we can try to infer what the value that the household receives by looking at how the other household members respond in terms of labor supply, the type of wages that they accept or reject after someone drops a formal job to someone in the household. So that's where the inspections again come in.
How many dual income households are there in Mexico? Female employment's quite low in Mexico, is it not?
Female employment is low, but actually we don't need both household members to be working in order for the identification strategy to work.
Mm-hmm.
We just need for there to be a change in that, right? So that's precisely that sort of variation that we're leveraging, right? So you have some households where both people are working. You have some households where one partner, usually the male, is working, but the female isn't. And then we say like, okay, well, conditional on the initial labor market statuses, let's shock these households with a formal job and then see where different partners respond. And that actually allows us to look at whether there's heterogeneity in the value of receiving a formal job, depending on whether the person who gets the formal job is female or male. As you pointed out, because labor force participation is fairly low for women in households that have couples as a head of household, it's less precise in the case of the women's measurement,
mm-hmm.
but we can still do it, which is an interesting aspect of the research. And there's good reasons to expect there to be heterogeneity too. Among other things, because during our sample period, only women who were formal got the daycare benefits.
Right.
So if you had a household, which is the most common configuration, by the way, if you had a household where the male was formally employed
mm-hmm.
and the woman wasn't,
mm-hmm.
and you had kids in daycare age,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't get the daycare benefit.
Got it.
And then someone sued the government over that.
As you pick your way carefully through this, data. It's like a matrix of various things happening and various responses. What does it come out at then as the value of a formal job?
So one of the key takeaways of the project is that the value of formality is positive, but there's a lot of heterogeneity across income levels.
Yeah.
So in particular, low-income households have a high valuation for a formal job, but their net benefit is negative. And the reason for that is twofold. One is that the non-contributory social benefit system is available for low-income households. And then the second reason is that actually the tax law is fairly regressive in Mexico. So there's a lower bound. So you at least need to pay a certain amount of contributions for any worker, regardless of what their wage is. That's equal to 20.4% of the minimum wage. So at the very least, the employer has to pay 20.4% of the minimum wage. And then there's also an upper bound to how much you contribute for any one worker. So that makes it such that for like low-income workers, the marginal tax rate is something like 36%.
Yeah, they're getting a poor deal there compared to someone who earns a lot more than them.
I think historically, a lot of people have thought that the reason why we see low formality rates within low-income households was partly because of the existence of this parallel system. They don't value the job. What we find in these preliminary results is that what creates the negative net value is the cost, rather than the low benefits.
But the value that households give to having a formal job, that's positive.
Yes. For the median household, it's around 5 percentage points higher than the cost to the firm.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
So looking at this from the policy point of view, finally, I mean, I guess we could talk about the policy in two different ways. If the government's policy is to increase the size of the formal sector, is this policy of inspections and the other policies that are in place around it, is that working?
I'm going to be a stickler again and say, you mean the size of the formal employment?
Oh.
I don't want the informality literature to come at me afterwards and be like, you said informal sector.
They don't forgive.
We don't. The International Labour Organization went through a lot of trouble to provide us with some guidelines about how to define and measure different things so that it's homogeneous across countries and time. So,
absolutely. So let me rephrase. If the goal is to increase formal employment,
yes,
is that policy working?
So, depends, I guess. It depends. As a good economist, I need to say it depends. So the reason why I say that is that, as we were discussing earlier, one of the findings is that actually formal employment, the size of a formal firm in terms of how many formal workers it hires, actually declines, right?
Yeah.
Like formal employment growth declines by a lot, and this decline is persistent. So if what you wanted to do is to have firms that are larger in the formal sector and like firms that have more formal employment, we actually see a drop in that. It has this like unintended consequence. But if instead what we're trying to do is formalize workers that basically already have a foot in the door in the formal sector, right? They're already employed at a formal firm. So for them, there seems to be a positive effect. And then one more caveat is that one of the findings in the second paper, the one about households, is that their spouse is now less likely to be formal. Imagine you're a household, you're making a joint decision, you're getting the benefits of a formal job. There's no need for both of us to pay the taxes. There's a lot of moving parts to this question. Policymakers have to be very careful to take that into account.
I hardly dare ask the last question then, Brenda. Okay. If we were to say that the policy goal is to increase the well-being of working people in Mexico, is that policy working?
Yeah, that's a tough one. People value a formal job. They value it by more than it costs a firm to formalize them. So that's important. Whether the policy to achieve that welfare should be inspections, it's unclear. You were asking me earlier whether the government wants to shrink the formal sector. Yes, but at the same time, it's like a self-inflicted wound because a lot of this is created by the incentives of these parallel regulatory frameworks. So if we wanted to increase welfare, I feel like the policy should be, let's remove this artificial distinction between formal and informal jobs and have like general taxation, social benefits.
Brenda, thank you for correcting my terminology.
Apologies.
No, it is important to get this right because, as you say, these are complex questions and they're important questions as well. And also, as you've shown, there are sometimes unintended consequences to policies. So thank you very much.
No, thank you.
If you want to read more about this, there are two papers. So the first one, Increasing the Cost of Informal Employment, Evidence from Mexico. And the authors, Brenda, who you've just heard from, and Leon Fernandez Bujanda. It is published in the American Economic Journal Applied Economics, 2024. And look out for How Much is a Formal Job Worth? Evidence from Mexico, which is Brenda and Bhavya Sharma.
You have been listening to Conversations on Transformation, recorded live at the STEG Annual Conference Week 2024 at NYU Abu Dhabi. STEG stands for Structural Transformation and Economic Growth, and you can find out more about it at steg.cepr.org.